This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Hi folks, my name is Yvonne Lau, and I'd like to tell you a story. I'm not a historian, but I love history, especially Chinese American history. I grew up here in San Francisco's Chinatown in a Chinese herb shop, which is kind of a unique experience, but that's not the story I want to share today. Instead, I want to tell you a bit about the history of Chinese herbal medicine here in America. Chinese medicine is an ancient medical system that's thousands of years old, but still widely used today. In fact, it's used in 196 countries and regions around the world, so a huge number of people have tried it in some form. In China alone, it has 1.2 billion users, and at least 1.5 million here in the US. It has a very sophisticated diagnostic system and uses different tools for treatment, including acupuncture, Tui Na massage, and Qigong exercises, but at its core, it's a medicinal herb tradition. Chinese herbs have a surprisingly long history here. In fact, they were here for about 100 years before a Chinese person ever set foot in America. During America's colonial period, so the 1700s, trade with China already went both ways. Chinese tea and herbs such as rhubarb, cinnamon, cardamom, and camphor crossed the ocean to the New World, while North American furs and herbs such as Appalachian wild ginseng went east. White Americans learned about Chinese medicine not only through the herbs they consumed, but also through European and American merchants, missionaries, and medical scientists who went to China. There, many of them studied and sometimes adopted Chinese therapeutic practices. Chinese medicine was such an interesting and important point of interest that by the mid-1700s, the Bencao Gangmu, the famous 16th century Chinese pharmacopoeia, had already been translated into English. Although this was a foreign medical tradition, Americans of this era already relied heavily on plant-based medicines, so taking Chinese herbs wasn't strange at all. During the Gold Rush era of the 1850s, Chinese migrants, almost exclusively men, came to America in significant numbers, and nearly all were Southern Chinese from the Pearl River Delta areas of Guangdong Province. Since they were going to a foreign country and would be away for years, they brought their health practices with them. So every sojourner was sure to have herbal remedies in their luggage. Among the migrants were also herbal doctors who, like everyone else, came here seeking opportunity away from the crippling poverty and political turmoil in China at the time. By this time, white Americans were accustomed to consulting with non-white healers, whether Native American, African, or Chinese. Since Chinese medicine has such a robust diagnostic and treatment system, illnesses and injuries were very successfully cured, and over time, ordinary Americans learned to associate Chinese medicine with magical healing powers. Many Chinese practitioners became famous and well-respected by whites, and some became very wealthy and leaders in the Chinese community. In fact, the first Chinese millionaire, in today's dollars, was a Chinese medicine doctor and shop owner named Li Po Tai, whose shop was on Washington Street near Portsmouth Square here in San Francisco Chinatown. He was so renowned, he even had the governor of California at the time, Leland Stanford, and his wife as patients. Many herb doctors in San Francisco were also importers, like Li Po Tai, and they sold herbs to their fellow practitioners across the country. Chinese frontier doctors primarily served the small communities that sprang up in mining camps and along the route of the Transcontinental Railroad, treating Chinese workers and even some whites. Others spread and established small Chinese enclaves further east, like in Chicago and New York and down in the Mississippi Delta. You can learn more about them online and sometimes even visit the preserved clinics of famous frontier doctors like Doc Ying He of John Day, Oregon, and Dr. Yifeng Zheng, who treated out of his Chu Qi store of Fiddletown, California. Especially in these far-flung places, herb shops were often the center of Chinese migrant life. They not only provided medical help, but also served as a general store, the post office, the bank, and even the place for community worship. Unfortunately, when the easy gold mining dried up and the Transcontinental Railroad was finished, whites struggled to find work. Generally keeping to themselves, whether by choice or in reaction to prejudicial hostilities, the Chinese became scapegoats when menial labor became the only work available. Chinese had always received less pay for the same work, like toiling in fields or fisheries, and had been willing to do so-called women's work, like cooking and laundry, but were now resented for taking away jobs from whites. Racism and resentment became rampant. Chinese communities all over the country were burned down, people were beaten and driven from their homes, and often murdered. Survivors mostly fled to the safety of the larger Chinatowns, like in San Francisco. This discriminatory attitude and hostility was so widespread that in 1882, Congress passed the first in a series of exclusion acts, effectively stopping immigration from China. This is still the only set of laws in U.S. history to target the people of a specific country. These exclusionary laws only allowed for certain types of Chinese to come to America: the wealthy, diplomats, clergymen, students, and a few others. This barrier to entry gave rise to human trafficking, especially of women for prostitution, and caused a subsequent decline of the Chinese population in the U.S. that lasted well into the mid-20th century. These exclusionary practices profoundly affected the makeup of the Chinese population in the U.S. and led to a so-called bachelor society. Because they were afraid that if they went home to visit, they wouldn't be allowed back in, tens of thousands of Chinese men never again saw the families they left behind in China. So instead of being the sojourners as they had originally intended, in order to feed their families back home, these men endured lonely lives, and most didn't return to China until their bones were shipped home for burial. With the lack of immigration and the extremely low number of Chinese women in America, Chinese communities in most small towns dwindled and then vanished as their populations died off or moved away during the early 20th century. We can see reminders of these outposts in the names of small towns, such as Chinese Camp, Lock, and Chu Kee Store, now Fiddletown. These discriminatory laws also affected and reduced trade, making herbs so difficult to get that some Chinese herbalists began growing them themselves and searched for equivalent native herbs. The more enterprising herbalists even started to integrate Western herbs into their treatments. Like most people and businesses, Chinese herb shops struggled during the Great Depression of the 1920s. Chinese, along with other Asians, were relegated to the bottom of society and continued to be discriminated against when it came to work of every kind. Fortunately, the family clan, mutual aid, and benevolent associations in Chinatowns provided enough assistance to protect their residents from starvation and legal help in applying for government aid. These lifeline organizations still exist today. In San Francisco alone, there are still over 100 of them. Although Chinatowns began to prosper in the late 1930s because of the end of Prohibition and a boom in tourism, mid-century wars in Asia further disrupted supply lines, making it difficult to restock herb drawers and shelves. During World War II and the Cold War, America recruited scientists, including biomedical doctors, through new immigration policies and educational exchange programs. Highly qualified refugees from China who were fleeing civil war and political prosecution, and American-born Chinese, began to pursue careers in licensed medical professions rather than practice Chinese medicine. As the American Medical Association, the AMA, came into prominence, pushing forward its Western science and the regulation of the medical marketplace, confidence in traditional therapies eroded further, and many Chinese herb shops across the country shuttered their businesses during this time. Although the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act was finally repealed in 1943, visas for Chinese immigrants were still limited to about 100 per year. During this time, women were only about 30% of the Chinese population, and this increase in percentage was really only because the men of the old bachelor society had died off. Most of these women were American-born. It wasn't until the signing of the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965 that a fresh wave of Chinese immigrants came to America and revived communities as well as the business of Chinese herbs. My parents opened their herb shop in 1969 after their own immigration journey. At the time, most of the other herb shops in San Francisco Chinatown were run by very old men. When I was a kid in the 70s, only a few shops had a second generation working in or running them. I remember Superior Trading Company, the Great China Art Company, and Taisang Tong, all located on Washington Street. Sadly, all three shops no longer exist, as their third and fourth generations of American-born children opted instead for more mainstream professions. However, in the 70s, there was also a confluence of factors that provided new hope for Chinese medicine as well. There was a countercultural backlash to Western biomedical hegemony. There was the warming of relations between the U.S. and China after the Nixon visit, and then a seminal article by James Reston of the New York Times that helped popularize acupuncture among American patient consumers. The licensure of acupuncture in Oregon, Maryland, and Nevada in 1973, and then California in 1976, helped to support the growth of the Chinese medicine profession. The earliest licensed acupuncturists were mostly doctors from mainland China, but there were white practitioners too, who were passionate about the medicine and became expertly trained in the use of Chinese herbs, able to diagnose and write complex herbal prescriptions customized to each patient. I remember my mom being really tickled when Caucasian practitioners came into our shop and were able to order herbs in passable Cantonese. This is because the Chinese medicine teachers they learned from and apprenticed with were mostly from Guangdong province. At the time, Chinese herbs were imported almost exclusively through Hong Kong, and Chinese herb businesses were still predominantly owned and operated by Cantonese people like my family. Another wave of Chinese immigrants in the 1990s, including doctors from all parts of China, led to a wider range of herbs being imported into the U.S. The popularity of patent or proprietary herbal medicines in pill, tablet, and capsule form grew because of their convenience and were preferred by patients who didn't like the taste of herbs. Over time, more and more ready-made medicines from China, Japan, and other parts of Asia came into the market. Significantly, in 1994, the United States Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, passed the Dietary Supplement Health Education Act, or DSHEA, which defined and regulated all dietary supplements, including Chinese herbs. This kind of opened the floodgates, and Chinese herbs began to appear in the mass market as dietary supplements, usually as a single ingredient instead of as a prescribed formula. Today, the multi-billion dollar U.S. dietary supplement industry uses about 95% of the Chinese herbs imported into the U.S., and the average consumer of astragalus root, lycium fruit, which you might know as goji berries, licorice root, and ginseng probably don't even know that they're taking Chinese herbs. Either way, it's been truly gratifying for me to see Chinese medicine, or at least acupuncture, become widely accepted here in the U.S. There are now over 35,000 licensed acupuncturists in practice across the country, and more than half dispense herbs. Thousands of modern, peer-reviewed research articles from around the world can attest to the value of Chinese medicine in treating disease and benefiting human health. In 2015, millions of Chinese around the world watched with pride as Chinese researcher Dr. Tu Youyou received the Nobel Prize for her research of a Chinese herb in treating malaria. Through it all, Chinese herb shops have weathered the ups and downs of history and have persevered. Now, a younger generation, mostly made up of recent immigrants, have taken up the mantle in Chinatowns and small Chinese enclaves around the country to provide familiar remedies to their aging communities. Although the use of Chinese herbs has declined among younger American-born and immigrant Chinese, herbs and herbal products can be found in Asian grocery stores and Western natural food retailers. Chinese herbs can now also be easily purchased online, supporting good health and longevity in even far-flung, remote places where maybe a Chinese mining camp once thrived. As the popularity and accessibility of Chinese herbal medicine in America continues to evolve, it's heartening to see how this ancient medicine, once used solely by an outcast, disenfranchised people, has come to finally be embraced by its adopted land. Thanks for joining me today on this history lesson.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.